Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Legacy Finance Division meeting to order. I don't know if anybody's had an opportunity to take a peek at the minutes. Representative Erdahl, have you had an opportunity to look at the February 26th minutes?
Representative Lilly, these are some of the best minutes I've ever seen, and I would move their approval. Your staff is doing just a fine job.
Wow, thank you. Representative Erdahl, thank you for the staff for our team and or the compliment for our team. We have the minutes before us. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. First bill up today will be House File 3591, Representative Becker Finn. And so I'll move that House File 3591 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative, and go ahead when you're ready, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, if you would be so kind as to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. I was lucky. My star staff was actually pointing towards it. There's an A1 amendment. Any questions to that? Just to get it looks like it's a date, some date changes, and just to get it in the shape that the author would like, and then we can discuss it further. Any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? So the amendment is approved, and we have your bill before us. And go ahead when you're ready, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 3591 hopefully you've read it. So it relates to chronic wasting disease, prions, and water. And it's an appropriation from the Clean Water Fund to address. There's a lot we don't know about how these prions can move in water, and for those of you who are on the environment committees, we've had a lot of discussion about leachate when it comes to disposing of carcasses, and we really don't know whether the prions can move through water, and there are a lot of differences in soil and different waterways throughout our state. And without further ado, I do want to make sure most of my time is given to the researchers from the U of M who have some really good information, sort of why this is important and why now, and sort of why this would be really helpful information for us all to have, whether you're involved in environment, ag, all kinds of different things, would be good information for us to have as we continue this fight against chronic wasting disease.
Thank you very much, Representative. I know you've been a leader on this issue, and I've been following some of it in the environment committees and, of course, reading it all over in the news, and very much appreciate that your efforts on this. And
all right, testing.
Okay,
all right,
I think we're a go.
I think we got it.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to Bill. He's been super helpful today in this room.
So go ahead and state your name for the record, please, and go ahead.
Chair Lilly, my name is Dr. Peter Larson. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm joined here today by Dr. Diana Carwin and Dr. David Seelig, also from the University of Minnesota. And we thought we'd start with just a brief presentation by myself to cover really the biology, the basics of biology of CWD. What is it about this disease that makes it of an environmental concern, and how does that relate to water? So, again, what is CWD? How does this disease relate to water issues in the state of Minnesota? Well, CWD is a progressive and fatal neurodegenerative disease of cervids. This disease impacts all cervids. That includes caribou, elk, mule deer, white-tailed deer. It's not caused, this disease is not caused by a virus or bacteria. It's caused by a misfolded prion protein. And I'm going to use these slinkies you'll see as an illustration of that to help us understand what a misfolded prion protein is. The disease was first identified in Colorado in the 1960s, and it's been spreading throughout the United States, North America, but also internationally in South Korea and Norway since the 1960s. So what is a prion? So on the right there, you can see a ribbon diagram. This is an illustration of what scientists use to visualize proteins. So all mammals have prion proteins. It's part of normal cellular function. Prion proteins bind to copper, and they play a role in nerve cells, help nerve cells function, part of the functional component of our nervous system. And one way that we illustrate that is using a slinky. So this is a three-dimensional issue, okay? When we're talking about proteins, we're talking about three dimensions. If you look at this slinky, it flows, right? It has a function. If we were to put this downstairs, right, it would travel down the stairs like a normal slinky would. So view this as a normal functioning prion protein that all mammals have, that all cervids, all deer have, okay? So what happens with CWD is, and other prion diseases, that protein, this normal protein, becomes misfolded. It changes its shape. It gets all messed up, and it develops these sheets, these misfolded sheets called beta sheets, and they stick together, and they form tangles. This is the infectious agent of CWD. When we talk about chronic wasting disease, we talk about prion misfolding. This represents that misfolded prion. This is the normal prion, okay? And one thing that's super interesting about this, and it's really unfortunate, it makes this disease really hard to manage, is that this molecule, when it misfolds like this, it becomes shielded. It almost becomes indestructible, okay? It can remain infectious in the environment for years. There are studies showing this. And this is this molecule, this misfolded protein, because it's shielded, it can survive in the environment and pass through the environment in different ways. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So this misfolded protein is what's of concern with environmental contamination. The way that this, when a deer is exposed to this protein, let's say it ingests it, a daisy chain reaction can start to happen in the animal, where this protein comes into contact with the normal prions, and it causes these to misfold, right? And so in the figure I'm showing there, you can see this daisy chain happening, where this interacts with other proteins in the animal, and those are enriched in nerve cells. And over time, the whole process takes about 2 years. Over time, these slowly colonize the brain and ultimately end up in the wasting away phenotype that you see on the right there. Okay, so they begin to colonize the brain and kill neurons. Typically, that process takes about 2 years. So this misfolded prion can be in saliva, semen, blood. It can be in the carcass of an animal. This can remain infectious in the soil for years, and there's estimates that range anywhere from 3 to 4 years all the way up to 10 years, and Dr. Seeley can help answer questions to that end. But this can be really, really resistant, and there's recent studies showing that this molecule, if it gets in the environment, it can be taken up by plants through the root system and actually deposited on the leaves. So it's hypothesized that deer coming along can be exposed to this if the molecule's in the environment and if the plants have brought that up and expressed it in their leaves. But this can also be transported by water runoff from CWD positive areas. So where is CWD right now in the state of Minnesota? The counties highlighted in yellow there are counties where CWD has been described, and that can be either in a farm situation or in the southeastern part of the state, like around Winona County and whatnot. Preston area, it's distributed in the wild, in wild services, okay, in wild white tail deer. So it's thought that over time, and this is what we see when CWD spreads in other states like Wisconsin, Colorado, that can occur along riparian zones, areas where deer congregate, okay, and that includes areas around streams and rivers. But CWD positive areas in each one of those counties represent potential point sources for new infections. So this is why it's really super important to understand the ecology of CWD. Right now, we don't have really any research focused on that in the state of Minnesota. There's been a few papers talking specifically about the hydrology of CWD. There's a paper published by Nichols et al. Out of Colorado where they showed CWD prions. These prions were detected in snowpack melt runoff from CWD endemic areas. And they also detected those prions at a water treatment facility downstream of the CWD endemic area. So using laboratory methods, which I'll highlight in a couple slides, they're able to detect these prions in water runoff from areas that CWD-positive deer congregate. There's also a second study, the survival infectious prions in water, that shows the more organic material in water, the longer the prions can remain infectious. And this spills over into the expertise of Dr. Diana Carwin here. She can help us understand, based on her research as a hydrologist, how, you know, what kinds of experience can we look at to understand how the relationship between organic material in the water and CWD prions, what does that look like in the state of Minnesota? So right now, with respect to the hydrology of CWD in Minnesota, there's zero data on this issue. We don't understand basic questions like how far do these prions travel from a CWD positive region? How far? Are these infectious? Right? Can they actually cause disease? And Dr. Seeler can talk a little bit about his research background, where we can actually get a mouse model set up at the University of Minnesota to test whether or not, if we find these in the environment, if we find these in water runoff, are they actually infectious? Are these prions ending up in wells or water treatment facilities? We don't have a good idea about that yet. And it's because that we haven't really had the technologies available in a laboratory setting within the state to look at this, but we do now. So this is the broader team looking at environmental contamination concerns and the hydrology of CWD in Minnesota. And I'll just, I won't be able to go through and highlight everyone's background here, but we have a diverse team of Diana's a hydrologist, ecologists, biologists to really help focus on this issue. We have formed the Minnesota Center for Prion Research and Outreach, or MINPRO, and some of you are aware that members of our team have focused on developing new diagnostics for CWD, but part of those funds secured to develop new diagnostics have resulted in the acquisition of new technology called RT-Quick. And that RT-Quick method basically leverages this aspect of the prions in a test tube. So we can use this RT-Quick method to detect, are there misfolded prions that interact with normal prions in a test tube? And we're able to measure that using graphs like what has appeared there in that middle image on this slide. So we have now the resources, the laboratory environment to be able to do the research that we're proposing here today. So that includes, so this is the subject of HF 3591. And what we're proposing is a 5-year research plan to better understand the hydrology of CWD in Minnesota. Key research areas are to identify the mechanisms for the environmental spread of CWD, to quantify prion abundance on and downstream of CWD point sources, and we can use that information to forecast and help model the spread of CWD. That's critical information for those tasked with managing the disease in our state. That includes the Board of Animal Health, the DNR. We can work together, and we are working together with both the Board of Animal Health and the DNR on environmental issues of CWD. All that information can be used to help inform remediation strategies. There's actually methods being used now in places like South Korea where they're going into CWD-positive farms and they're treating the soil and they're removing these infectious prions from the soil, and they're doing it in a controlled way. So that way, that will help us for several reasons. One, if we can figure out ways to remediate that will prevent these from going downstream and interacting with, you know, wild, causing different outbreaks in wild, but can also help the cervid farming industry prevent the spread of CWD associated with farms. So that's all the information that we can generate will help inform remediation strategies. And I believe all of you have a budget that's associated with this, and we're happy to answer any detailed questions you'd like about that budget. I thank you for your time today, and I will turn it over to Dr. Carwin.
Thank you, Dr. Larson, and go ahead.
Yes, Doctor. Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and answer your questions here today. So I'm Dr. Diana Carwin. I've been a hydrologist in CFANS, or the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Science at the UMN Twin Cities since 2013. And really my specialty and my strong interest in working with the CWD team is I think about how water and soils and organic carbon move between landscapes and waterways in the state. And so, as you've heard from my colleagues, CWD, we're really not sure quite how it moves around in the environment. And what's been found in other states, such as studies in Colorado and Arizona, are things like binding onto soil and binding onto organic matter can make a difference. And what you've seen in the slideshow in the previous examples is that we have CWD testing positive on farms around the state. So what we've tried to do is design a set of experiments to look at the various types of soil and water environments around the state of Minnesota where we're getting positive CWD testing, and to try and take material from those environments, bring it into the MinPro labs first, and think about what are those environmental variables that can tell us something about how locked it is on the soil and or how likely it is to move in water. And then we will take the results of those lab studies in years 3 through 5 of the studies that we've outlined and use those in conjunction with other data that's available in the state where we can produce a set of risk maps for how likely CWD would be to move. So we can combine this with information that the state has put resources into already on things like soil erosivity. How likely are the soil on these farms to erode and end up in waterways? Knowledge of hydrology in terms of the structure of the streams and the rivers and the lakes, where if material were to end up in these waterways, could it move quickly further downstream, or is it more likely to end up in a lake where it's staying in one place? So these series of studies that rely on environmental sampling, laboratory analysis to really inform environmental spread based on water movement in Minnesota is where we propose to go over these 5 years. And I'm happy to answer further questions on that when you have them. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Mr. Larson?
Or Dr. Larson? I think we are ready for any questions that the committee might have. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a question from a member, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a couple questions. First of all, is there any danger to human beings from this?
Thank you. Doctor, please state your name.
That's fair enough. My name is Dr. David Seelig. I'm an associate professor. I'm in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota. So thank you so much for the question. The current body of evidence suggests that there is the risk to humans for CWD is exceptionally low. There are recommendations that we can do to mitigate that risk, and consumption of known positive materials is certainly one risk factor that can be selectively removed from our behavioral patterns. That said, so much of the current scientific body of evidence about the risk of CWD to humans is based upon a relatively small number of studies, studies using animal model systems, similar to what we've proposed to do in our studies to determine infectivity. There are a number of variables that we don't necessarily know, which we haven't really addressed quite yet, but one of the things we're interested in looking at is, and this may go a little bit askew of your original question, but I promise I will circle back to it, is there's this concept in prions called strains. We talk about viral strains as being sort of unique, genetically unique forms of viruses that have different infectivity characteristics. Traditional sort of the flu virus strain varies every year or so. There are similar strains in prion diseases as well. And one of the things that we don't know that we will learn from the work that we've proposed is what strains of prions are unique to the state of Minnesota? What strains of prions are unique to the water sources in the state of Minnesota, to soil compartments, to plant compartments in the state of Minnesota? And so, circling back to your question, what do we know about the risk of CWD to humans? Part of it is determining what are the risks of specific strains to humans. So we can model that in the laboratory using some of the techniques that Peter talked about, some of which are proposed in the bill as presented. But getting a sense of what is our prion strain distribution in the state of Minnesota, and then using some animal model systems to determine that risk. So in brief, the risk is likely very low, but at the end of the day, we need to learn more about the specific factors that contribute to that risk, one of which is strains and one of which is specific environmental distributions of strains, all of which will be addressed in the proposed bill.
And just real quick, I could add.
Dr. Larson.
So the CDC recommends do not consume CWD positive meat. Dr. Seelig is absolutely correct. Overall risk is super low. Because this is a three-dimensional molecule that we're talking about here, when Dr. Seelig said strain variation, what we're talking about is this molecule can have different shapes. And the concern that the CDC has is that there's going to be some shape out there in nature that this takes that can successfully bind to a human prion and cause it to misfold. So that's what we don't understand right now, is what are the shapes of these molecules in Minnesota?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if an animal has contracted this, is there any treatment available now or being developed other than just killing the animal?
Dr. Larson.
Chair Lilly and committee members. No, right now there is no treatment for CWD, and it's 100% fatal to cervids, okay, across all cervids. That's the last part of that, to cervids. So white-tailed deer, mule deer.
Elk. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Is there any treatment, vaccine, or anything being worked on?
Chair Lilly, committee members, there are labs across the U.S., probably across the world, who are actively looking at developing therapeutics for prion diseases. CWD is part of a spectrum of neurodegenerative diseases that includes Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans, scrapie in sheep. And so there are laboratories working on therapeutics. I'm not aware of any recent advancements specifically on therapeutic targets for CWD. But that spills over into a line of research that we are hoping that's independent of all of this in MinPro to engage at the University of Minnesota to look at those potential blocking molecules, if you will. If we develop a molecule that can block this, there may be a therapeutic approach. But that's beyond the scope of the current study.
Thank you.
Representative Bowe, I believe you have a question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick question, and that is, when you're doing research, how do you dispose of materials from research? Does it go through wastewater treatment, and does it flow on through into the environment, or what?
Representative Lilly, members
Mr.
of the committee.
Steele?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So in our laboratory, we have a number of protocols, decontamination protocols, that are approved for the effective destruction of prions, specifically the infectious and misfolded form. These are treatments that are exceptionally, exceptionally harsh. Very high concentrations of bleach, for example, are capable of degrading prions beyond the scope of what is acceptable for environmental remediation, but we have safe remediation strategies in our laboratory.
Representative Bowe?
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've mentioned research in other states and in other countries. Because of the urgency of this, is there something we can adapt or learn from those other efforts that means we start maybe a little further down the road?
Yeah. I'd be happy to start with that.
Go ahead, Doctor. Thank you.
Yes. So in terms of the hydrology and the environmental transport, absolutely. What we've learned from some of the studies in Colorado and Arizona is thinking about what else might be in the soil and the water that can affect whether or not this prion persists and remains infectious and is likely to move. So certain aspects of soil, such as presence of certain clays or clay fraction in the soil, that clay would have like a really high binding opportunity for this prion to latch onto that could make it more persistent, more likely to end up eroded into a waterway, for example. Secondly, organic matter. So we have differences in organic matter in our rivers across the state. You know, I spend a lot of time in northern Minnesota, and there are rivers there that are brown from organic matter from all the peatlands that are in the northern part of our state. And so we would be starting further ahead with being able to think about what are these other components of our water that could affect whether or not the prion can move in water and remain infectious. So it would be jump starting, say, that study design for the lab-based studies where we're taking material from the environment and exposing it to different types of water within the lab.
Representative Hausman. Thank you. Any public comments? Seeing none, I have a quick question about the kind of the bill itself. So on regards to the bill, so I understand that it seems a bit like scientific, so that's, I mean, it's all great and everything, and I get that. I understand the LCCMR bill is still open, and I was just curious what's the status there, or if you've had an opportunity, given that you're Lessard Sam's member, were you able to have discussions on these issues? I know in years past, Representative Hansen and when I were on there, we talked about some MRI ash borer and some other, you know, more rather invasive kind of issues, which just might fit into categorically or something. And if you've had an opportunity to talk to the clean water folks as well, so kind of three-pronged questions. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, I mean, as folks know, I mean, we're kind of talking to everybody across a lot of different councils and committees as to different ways that we can take on this disease. I know we've talked about chronic wasting disease, certainly on the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, as far as how it relates to making sure that we're making smart investments with the land that might be acquired through that bill. But as you are familiar with the Outdoor Heritage Council too, you know, those are the proposals that kind of go through the process, and they're more focused on conservation than necessarily something like this. So that's why we brought it forward in this fund. But certainly, I mean, if there's any other fund that you would like to make this investment from, we would be happy to do that. And I do want to add too that, you know, really the idea here, you know, this is a 5-year study. The idea is that if we make this investment, it can better inform our long-term containment and management strategy sort of across the board in how we manage our water as well as our natural resources, and I think could potentially make future strategies more efficient and more focused on making sure that we're not kind of necessarily putting effort into a place where it isn't necessary once we kind of know more. And so I do think that this would be really helpful, beneficial information as we have outbreaks of other prion diseases. I know there's a scrapie active in Pennsylvania right now. You know, I'm sure that could happen here as well. And so I think the benefits are long-term in making it, this investment, kind of regardless of which pot of money it comes from. But did want to start the conversation here.
Thank you, and I'm not necessarily against it, you know, but I very much value it, and I love the work that the U has done in so many different areas with carp and other things that I'm probably more familiar with than this. My questions, I think, stirred a couple more, so Representative Heitzman, and then Representative Wozlik will be after that. So Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You took my question, but I'll continue the conversation here. So you're hitting on something that is a question mark. I serve on the Clean Water Council, and we have had some high-level discussions over the course of developing our new strategic plan, and we do wonder about how some of these other funds maybe should be picking up their share of this kind of work. And I pulled up the LCCMR mission statement while I was waiting, and if we're looking for a mission statement literally written for this kind of a project, I think that's it. And the project in and of itself needs to be funded. Mm-hmm. I think that this is something that just about everybody can agree on. It'd just be a matter of where, and maybe the Clean Water Council isn't the best direction for that. There's probably a lot of others that'll weigh in on it as the conversation continues beyond this committee. But being as we do have a current situation where there is no formal recommendation from the LCCMR, and it's open technically, we should definitely be talking about what we might possibly be doing in this legislative cycle. So hopefully, if there's an option there to fund that through maybe a more appropriate fund, that would be considered.
Thank you, Representative Heitzman, and Representative Becker-Finn, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe Representative Heitzman is also a member on LCCMR, so would love his support through that avenue if you know, if we can get on the same page as far as supporting this research, because it is important.
That makes four things.
It's good. We're seeing some team building here. Vice Chair Wozlik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the map from your slideshow about where CWD is in Minnesota, and this is a 5-year project, and I'm wondering if you can speak to, obviously you can't make predictions about how things are going to go between now and 5 years from now, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how, you know, given that time period, what might things look like in 5 years, and is this going to be soon enough, I guess, is my concern.
Dr. Larson?
Members of the committee, that's a great question. The question is, like, where will CWD be in the state within, you know, the next 5 years? It's very difficult to answer because there's so many. It's such a complex disease and how it moves around. Certainly on that map, all those, you know, red arrows, there's definitely CWD positive farms that have occurred over the last, I think, since 2012, right, I think, in the state. Each one of those is a potential point source, and we can work with the Board of Animal Health, and we can work with the farm owners to take a closer look at the CWD prions on those and what's running off, you know, downstream. Because this molecule lasts, you know, in the environment for a long time, then, you know, it's likely that many of those sort of red arrows up there have valuable information we can learn from. Studies by the DNR and others are showing that certain collared deer, like down around the Preston area, they can go and travel for like 60 miles, right? And so as the DNR conducts their biosurveillance effort, we'll be able to see where CWD is spreading in the wild, right? And so I think, you know, it's difficult to say where this will be in 5 years, but for certain, as each new farm is identified, that becomes an area that we would want to rapidly go and work with the farm owner and work with the Board of Animal Health to understand the ecology of that and what's running off of that downstream, which could impact the wild population, right? And so our team is trying to work with everybody, right, on that issue. So it's just the way that this disease spreads, it can be very complicated because it's not just spread of deer, you know, in the wild through behavioral natural history of deer, but it's also human driven.
Yeah, I think the deer can't just wash their hands and not touch their face on this one. So I just want to be.
Thank you very much, doctors, for coming today. And Representative Becker-Finn, I'll give you a final comment. And I think Lead Heitzman kind of captured it. I think we all value this. And I hats off to you for bringing it forward and having a discussion. And we'll find a home for it and figure it out. We got some great team working on it. Author Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did want to mention, too, that we do have hot spots in hunter-harvested deer as well, where we have multiple positives in a small area, and we don't know why that is. You know, like the same family having multiple deer in multiple years coming up positive, even though we don't have any other prior documented positives. And so I think this is the kind of thing where when I ask the DNR, like, why here, what this kind of research, and I think sort of to represent Wozniak's question, you know, incrementally, I'm sure there are things we'll find out in year one that will help us as we move forward, things that you learn in year two. So just really appreciate the discussion and your support for addressing this issue. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. With that, I renew my motion that House File 3591, as amended, be laid over for consideration. Thank you very much, Representative, and thank you, doctors, all of you, for the great work you're doing for Minnesota.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen, the second bill is House File 3513, and I'll move that House File 3513 be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Hansen, welcome. You could probably comment on that previous issue. I know you were very involved with testing in southeastern Minnesota and watching the harvest. And go ahead with your bill or however you want to.
Well, Mr. Chair, I should have brought some of the venison from my refrigerator that's non-detected.
Chair Hansen.
Next time. And just something that may relate to the bill in front of as well. I think the Clean Water Fund has funded a variety of things over its lifetime. Representative Hausman would remember we funded LIDAR mapping at about 22 to 24 million. Representative Murphy remembers that as well. That was basic research that helped out on for years to come and is still being used that the University of Minnesota provided. We paid for rulemaking for the Mississippi River critical area. We also banned coal tar in clean water bills. So there's a variety of things. So every fund has its guardians that say that keep your hands off my fund and go into the other fund. And, you know, there was, I think, an emphasis back in a guidebook one time saying maybe the funds should work together and fund a little bit all together to make something happen. And the bill in front of you, House File 3513, I have had in a couple of other committees, and I'm bringing it here. There is the bill that went through that's in Ways and Means right now is an identical bill, but from the general fund. If there was a surplus dollars and there was enough money in my target that I could put that in. But it relates to the Conservation Reserve Program. And the Conservation Reserve Program is a federal program that just went through a sign-up period called a general sign-up. And what the Conservation Reserve Program does is it's a voluntary program to enroll land into conservation for wildlife purposes, for water quality purposes, to prevent soil erosion, and to help pollinators as well. And it has been in existence, I think, since the 1985 Farm Bill in one way or another. There are over 1 million acres that are enrolled in the state of Minnesota, usually for 10 to 15-year contracts. And the landowners who enroll in that land have to put native vegetation, can be 30 mixed seeds, or it could be a different mix, could be trees, to enroll it into conservation, and they receive a rental payment from the federal government. The current enrollment in the current farm bill, the farm bill set a rate, and it lowered the rates for the county average rental rate in about half of the counties in Minnesota was reduced. And it also set a rate below that rate for the maximum rent to be for the general CRP sign up 15% under the county average rental rate, and for continuous sign up, and those are the buffers, the smaller tracts along rivers, lakes, and streams, to be 10% under the county average. The continuous CRP, which is what my bill here is, an ongoing enrollment. It cannot be more than 10 acres, so it's designed not for large fields, but for buffers. But enrollment is weak, so to speak, with both the general sign-up and the continuous sign-up. I believe there are people here from Bowser who can give an up-to-date summary a bit, because the general sign-up closed last Friday. But people are not enrolling because the rental rate is not competitive with keeping the land in production. So my bill asks for $1.75 million from the Clean Water Fund to one-time incentive payments. So that what that would be is based on its water quality or wildlife benefit. Let's say if you have more seeds, more mix of natives, maybe you get paid $200 an acre as a sign-up bonus. Maybe if it's a more basic mix, you get paid $100 an acre. So we give the authority to Bowser to set up a rate where you can give some type of frosting on the cake, so to speak, to make it somewhat competitive so that we can get this land re-enrolled, because there will be land that is currently in native vegetation and providing a water quality benefit that is going to come out and go back into crop production. And so it is a 10, or the continuous CRP is a 15-year sign-up. I think it is perfectly appropriate for a Clean Water Fund incentive to try to get, and we could target it for those water quality benefits along rivers, lakes, and streams to keep that land into conservation. And that is the bill. And I was trying to get Representative Gunther to come down, because I know he's an author on the general fund one, and I just didn't get to him on this one.
Representative Hansen, we have a question from Representative Erdahl, so I'm going to go there for now.
Representative Erdahl. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hansen, you know, I'm just a little bit unclear how things are operating this year, because I don't know that we're having a supplemental budget on legacy funding. Is there a bill in the Senate, a companion bill, and how do you see that progressing?
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, there is a companion bill of the general fund that Senator Rood has authored and has the other four co-authors, our Republican co-authors.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And since you mentioned that Senator Rood has the bill, then I concerns I have are alleviated.
Mr. Chair, let me make sure I'm
Chair
clear.
Hansen.
That is the general fund if there's a supplemental budget. This bill in front of you is using the Clean Water Fund and is any port in the storm.
Representative Heitzman.
Should I say what he just said?
No,
I won't.
No. Any comments from the public? I don't see. Oh, yeah, please come up. Thank you. Please state your name and go ahead when you're ready. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Sheila Vanney, I'm the Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And our association represents the 440 elected SWCD supervisors across the state, as well as their 380 employees. And I want to thank Representative Hansen once again for carrying this bill and bringing this issue forward. In our 80-plus years of history with SWCDs, we have a long-established working relationship with our partners over at USDA, both at the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Farm Service Agency, who would jointly administer the CRP program at the local field office level. FSA handles the enrollments, and NRCS is tasked with writing the conservation plans that go along with those practices. And SWCDs are often partners in helping write those conservation plans or even going out and soliciting interest from landowners to enroll in the program. We have actually also observed the declining interest in landowners either enrolling or re-enrolling in CRP, and we do have an interest in making sure that those conservation lands either stay in their plantings or do get enrolled in new CRP plantings. So we appreciate the efforts to try to make this program make better financial sense to landowners at the local level, and we stand ready as SWCDs to help facilitate those incentives getting to landowners.
Thank you, Ms. Fanning. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as I sit here and further reflect on my previous question, it comes to mind, since there is some money available this year in legacy funding for this, the question becomes, why does Senator Rood prefer to use general fund dollars for this? And I don't expect it's something you can just answer unless you know the answer. But perhaps Chair Lilly or someone could ask Senator Rood why she thinks that general fund dollars are more appropriate than using the legacy funding that is intended for this.
Representative Erdahl, I had an opportunity to visit with the chair of the Senate Legacy Committee last evening, and we had a nice conversation. I'm not sure that we're of like minds on some issues, but we'll have a House position and we'll be moving forward with the House position. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Erdahl, I center the general fund ones first. So if you would like to help with the clean water funds and obtaining the signatures, I'd be glad to work with you on that.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, any final comments, or is that good, Representative Hansen?
I do need to make one clarification how a landowner would participate is they would go to the federal government and then they would have to go walk down the hall and apply for the incentive payment. I have CRP applications in the queue, so I want to be clear that I would not be applying for anything if this bill passed. So I need to just make sure I'm clear on that.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Hansen. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3513 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Chair Hansen, and Again, thank you for the good discussion from members. Representative Gunther. Representative Heitzman, would you like to move that House File 3530 be laid over for possible inclusion?
I would like to make that motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lead Heitzman. With that, Representative Gunther, thank you. Welcome back to your committee as a former chair. And we have quite a few chairs here. I get a little nervous with Representative Murphy and Representative Erdahl and Representative Gunther. I played hockey, or at least saw a former chair, Khan, at hockey. She's not playing anymore, which is probably a good thing. But thank you for coming back to your committee, Chair Gunther.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members, it's a pleasure to be back here. I look forward to it all. Since I introduced this bill is, we worked on this bill first by calling the Greater Minnesota Trails person from Duluth and Ashley, and she looked at it and she said, we have very few trails down in my area, and this would be a good start. So with that, she said that we have the permission and we have the money to do this project. And in Fort Belmont was a 30-acre park in Jackson County. It's a county park. And I remember when I was a lot younger going there, and they used to have rendezvous where we had people dress up in the old trapping costumes and coonskin hats and all that stuff, and it was really kind of interesting. And that was my first introduction to the park. And now they want to do something much more up-to-date and creative with it, and with that, I'd love to introduce my testifiers from Jackson County.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Go ahead when you're ready, sir. State your name, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to speak today. My name is Jeff Johnson. I'm not the one who ran for governor, however. We're presenting you with some slide deck material, but out of respect of your time, we're just going to summarize that for you today. I'm a fast talker and a slow reader, so if you don't mind, I'm going to read to you why we believe this project has a high return on investment. I'm here on behalf of the Friends of the Jackson County Trails with support from the county as well as multiple municipalities and organizations to build the Southwest Minnesota off-road trails. Our friend Sam Espy presented 1 year ago, along with Luke, who is with us today. Sam talked about how he dreamed about utilizing Fort Belmont or Belmont Park into a mountain bike trail 10 years earlier. Many of us believe Sam's dream is not only an excellent idea for the obvious opportunity of surrounding a healthy lifestyle of all ages. Additionally, we discovered it could also fill a clear void in Southwest Minnesota. I hope you spend a couple of minutes going through all the benefits from this project for your residents in the Southwest and those that enjoy walking or biking in the woods throughout Minnesota. Another highlight, I believe, is this trail project is across the Des Moines River from the popular state park, Kylan Woods. That's in your slide deck. Sam wanted to be here again to present the why, but he is serving our country on what I believe is his sixth deployment with the military. Jeremy is also passionate about mountain biking and helping us lead this project journey with the absence of Sam. I am simply an ambassador for a healthy lifestyle. I have ran several marathons throughout Minnesota and competed in several Ironman triathlons. I believe one should go to church for their soul and exercise to enrich their life. The following is some of what Sam mentioned last time. Members of the Friends of the Trails group and community leadership began to see the benefits of having an off-road trail system in our backyard. Health benefits, economic benefits, general livability benefits. This trail system would be a draw for young professionals to move to our rural community, because we young professionals are looking for more than a job. We are looking for a place that supports our lifestyle. There's no question that mountain biking has been an economic benefit to Minnesota. These trails will bring a boost to our local economy as bike riders come to explore our trails. We mountain bikers are always looking for new trails to ride, and we spend a lot of money doing it. The park is situated between the cities of Jackson, Lakefield, and Windham, allowing for multiple communities to be a gateway to the trails. The trails would be a new outlet for exercise where entire families will be able to recreate together instead of watching from the sidelines. These trails have been designed with progressive loops that will be rideable by small children on balanced bikes with their grandparents and their thrill-seeking teenage siblings at the same time. These trails will be a potential host site for Minnesota High School Cycling League and will allow our area to start a competitive team to race in this rapidly growing sport. The trails have been designed and will be built to be to the standards of the NICA. In addition to high school competitions, I'd like to host events for all ages in the summer and winter months. Events that are otherwise hours away, this trail will be open and usable all year round by bikers and hikers. These trails will be sustainably built to discourage erosion and be maintained by volunteers to keep this gift that keeps giving usable for years. We also need to give majority of the credit to Dave DeYoung, who is with us today, and several grandmothers currently enjoying the southern climate. They are the pioneers of our trail systems. We have a really nice trail systems in Jackson. We respectfully and would greatly appreciate your support for this project to complete Sam's vision, provide a healthy lifestyle option for Southwest Minnesota residents and off-road enthusiasts. I'll turn over now to Jeremy.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairman.
Go ahead. Please state your name and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Chairman, committee members. My name is Jeremy Bartosh. I'm the Parks Supervisor at Jackson County. I'd like to, we have about five parks in our county system that are mainly dedicated for people that bring their RV camper and camp out and enjoy the lake community. And we also have four sites which are more boat access, smaller playground facilities. But the one that's being mentioned today is kind of a very unique one that is very, that's the one at Belmont Park. It is not open for camping, but it's one that we'd like to develop for the single track mountain bike enthusiasts. When it was mentioned that, you know, how sometimes when one creates an idea about what wants to improve upon a park, you need to sometimes, you know, you have that problem of you need the property. Well, the benefit is we already have the property. And Trail Source is the contractor that the group has kind of had out and looked at the spot. We are from an area that is a lot of flat ground, corn and soybeans. And to really find an area that is wooded is really unique. And then with it being by the Des Moines River Valley, it really creates a golden opportunity. And this was mentioned by the designer of the trail, that this would be a unique opportunity that isn't seen in this part of the state. It was mentioned that it would be built to National Interscholastic Cycling Association standards. Because of that, we'd want to have the opportunity, and because of its location, it's right off of Interstate 90, just north of ways, off of another major road, Highway 71. We believe this would be a regional destination for people in the surrounding areas. We're not just, even though we recognize that it'll be a benefit for the areas in Jackson County, we're looking more broadly to our neighbors to the north, south, east, and west. And we get a lot of mountain bikers that are camping out at the state park, Highland Woods, and then they bring their bikes, and this would be an opportunity to really grow hold on. When I say that, it would include Minnesota. I want to also include our friends from across the border. We have many trails south of Jackson in our campgrounds that actually connect to Iowa and then include in Dickinson County their trail system. Speaking with some of their local bike shops in that area, they come up and they are very enthusiastic about this opportunity. One thing I want to mention also is that the opportunity, this isn't just something that's a hobby, like it was mentioned before. It's been quoted that it's a lifestyle change, lifestyle activity that can be started at a young age. The Minnesota High School League Association, they have these events in the summer. And even if you're not associated or you don't have enough team members or a school, you can join an area school that has a biking league in until one is formed. Because of the location, again, we are hopeful that there's interest from both Wyndham Public Schools, Jackson Public Schools, and even further out that we can get something started. With that, I just want to mention that because of the trails, there was some volunteer work done and a very a beginner level trail was built last summer at Belmont, and then we advertised it for the community to come out and really kind of explore what, even though it was like half a mile, it was something that they could see that if we really get this in the future of what is really to come. I took my two boys last summer after that was done. They are both 15 and 13. And let me tell you, they were pretty excited because they're used to taking off down the long driveway from our farm site and going on gravel roads. And so this was something very unique from them. And we would have had to have drove either to Mankato, which is the nearest one, or Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And so this is something that our local community will be very thankful for have if this is present. So I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, sir. And Representative Gunther, I think we are getting closer.
Right. Mr. Chairman, it kind of reminded me of a lead in my committee when I chaired this committee who loved the bike. It wasn't for an accident. He'd probably still be doing it. And I think when you are a biker, you look forward to not many things you do before that. So it's very important that we get this done. So I appreciate your help.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. We have some questions. So Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is a comment about the slide on your PowerPoint, which hopefully everybody read while you were speaking. On your slide on page 5, the boost the local economy. And I just want to lift that up a little bit because I saw that happen on the Cuyuna Trail. We went there before and we went there after. And you could visibly see, and they cite the impact there. As they were reporting after, the person recruiting physicians for the regional hospital came up to me and talked about how that bike trail had helped him recruit 18 physicians to that area. And to demonstrate, one of them was standing there with him all decked out in his biking gear. He had moved there from New York. And he pointed out that this group of physicians, they believe in work-life balance. And so they were making an intentional decision. And so literally seeing that. But what I've also learned from all of the local leaders who come to us from those towns around the state, they've described this economic transition. They've said, the economy of our town used to be based on the family farm, and the family farm is sort of disappearing. The economy of our town used to be based on the Main Street businesses, and the big box store outside of town has sort of closed them down. And now those visionary communities who are going to make it, who are going to transition to something, to a different kind of economy, they inevitably turn to things that some critics here call wants, not needs. And they describe them as arts and culture, parks and trails, museums, historic sites. It's their assets that they have that they build upon. And you can see places like Chatsfield and Lanesboro, for example, mm-hmm. where that has that transforming effect. So I just wanted to call attention to this particular slide and that measurable impact and visionary communities who understand what it means to reassess their local economy.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. That's very profound and so true. We've serving on your committee and now serving on Representative Murphy's and when it was Erdahl's committee as well, you'd hear that on bonding projects and others. I had a person in my office today that was had just over the weekend been up on Cayuga and just how much they enjoyed being up there riding. I'm hoping to get up on Duluth and ride theirs just right in the city. They have an amazing system. Chair Gunther, I did sign up for a race this summer, so we'll see if it's not really a race, but a 99 bike ride up a mile on the North Shore, so we'll see if I can, as long as I stay out of trees, I might stand a chance.
Let me know how you turn out.
Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a representative from the beautiful Southwest Metro, I appreciate a good bike trail. We have many down there, and I love, you know, the ability to enjoy that as a resident, but also bringing in visitors from out of town. So I'm intrigued by this site because, boy, there's a lot of steep slopes and such. It looks like it'll be a fun ride, but are there any issues with erosion when you're putting trails up and down steep slopes like that on the hillside?
So we've already had it engineered, thank you. We've already had it engineered, and the way they build a trail, they control the erosion with how they put the path in. So they're very strategic in that part of it. So thank you for that question.
Representative Bowe.
And I can't help but notice it's down close to the river, which will be very scenic, but are there chances that trail will be inaccessible from time to time with high water?
The elevation's quite a bit off higher than the river, so the flooding is not going to be a concern with this trail system.
Good enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Wozelek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Referencing your PowerPoint presentation, the slides that we have, it says that this particular park right now isn't being utilized very much and that there's a neighboring park that has kind of hiking and biking trails. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to maybe if there was any sort of I don't know if it was a study, but something done to show that if you invested here that people would actually be using these trails.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. Currently, Belmont Park is not being utilized at all. Very little. And Kylan Woods, which is right across the river, is highly very used throughout the year, well, in the summer, that is, very popular. So we believe, like was mentioned earlier from Bob, Mr. Gunther, that people that use Kylan Woods will bike over to this trail system, mountain bike trail system, and utilize it that way. So we have we believe that there's going to be highly utilized, and there's a lot of big interest in it. So did I answer your question, or?
Representative Wozelek.
I noted that you had a public hearing on this idea, and I was just wondering, is there a groundswell of support? I want to be sure that if we're going to invest money in this, that people are actually going to use it, and I didn't know if there was, I don't know if there's studies for those sorts of things, or if you heard that at the public hearing.
Yep, I'm Luke Ewald. I work with the Public Health Department in Jackson County, and we held a public hearing, I think it was August 6th of 2018, and that was with, we had someone from the DNR come with us. He was actually, he just ran for county commissioner, and he's part of our Friends of the Trails Committee. And the outcome, there were a number of folks that came, and everyone was pretty much in favor. In fact, I think we got a few folks to actually join our committee. There really wasn't any negativity. Maybe if there was, it was about, can we have horses on the trail? So I guess you could say the horse club came. Otherwise, landowners, there were not a whole lot of issues that we came across with that. So everyone's fairly open to it.
Thank you, Mr. Ewald. You're good?
Mr. Chairman, Kylan Woods.
Mr. Gunther.
Kylan Woods, a couple years ago, was threatened to be sold to the county or given to the county. And finally, somebody suggested they start advertising it. And one of the comments they made, it has cleaner restrooms than the average Holiday Inn. And the thing started filling up. There wasn't one space in the late, early fall to be had in the whole park. So people get to know there's a new place in town, just like the Willis Bike Trail. There are very few bike trails in southern Minnesota. And this is going to be one of them that I'm sure will be very well used eventually. And we will have competitive biking there, too.
Representative Erdolf, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just I'm wondering, as a show of support for this, the DNR official who ran for county commissioner, did he win?
Yep. Mr. Ewald.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
All right, then maybe.
Representative Erdolf.
Thank you. Well, then, you know, hopefully Gunther Trail will come to fruition.
So any final comments, Representative Gunther?
Mr. Chairman, I said enough.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming. I just want to make a So I'll renew the motion that House File 3530 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Gunther, and thank you, guests, very much for coming. Yesterday, I had an opportunity to be at an outdoor heritage dinner, and they said shooting sports are the seventh biggest sport in the state of Minnesota in a short few years. And I think these unconventional or untraditional sports, whatever you want to call them, such as mountain biking, are well on a path, you know, to meet up with the traditional footballs and soccers and sort of things. So thank you very much. So we had the water folks that came to our last meeting, and we had some questions that we just weren't able to get to totally. And so I was just hoping that Mr. Gardner could come, and then some others. I know Representative Wagenius had some questions. Representative Erdahl had another conflict and had to leave, and I'm not sure that Representative Murphy was able to have her question answered. As you're coming up, I think Representative Murphy has a question.
No, Mr. Chair, I don't have a question.
Okay. My misunderstanding, and my apologies. So welcome. Thank you for bringing a team with you, Mr. Gardner. And then I don't know where to – I think I'll start with Representative Erdahl, and then we'll go to Representative Wagenius, if that's okay. And do you want to – yeah. Representative Erdahl, do you recall your question?
I don't remember that I had a question.
You did. I'm sorry, Representative Erdahl.
I did.
We have a magical sheet, and I think it was three questions.
Well, if it comes to me, I'll raise my hand again.
Okay. So maybe you were able to talk offline. I'm not sure. Representative Wagenius, do you?
I actually do remember my question.
Okay.
We wrote them down.
Okay, great.
So there are three ways that Minnesotans get drinking water, one from private wells, public wells, and then from surface water. And my constituents, I think Representative Hausman's too, get their drinking water from surface water, which of the three is the most polluted. And in my case, our citizens get their water from the Mississippi River. There are about 1 million people who get their drinking water from the Mississippi River. It's Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Cloud, lots of the suburbs around Minneapolis and St. Cloud, and not St. Cloud, but Minneapolis and St. Paul. So the drinking water that we get comes out of, is taken out of the Mississippi north of Minneapolis. It's about 20 miles south of where the Crow River dumps into the Mississippi. The Crow is very, very polluted. There's been lots of studies showing that the Crow is very polluted. Yet, you don't, none of the testing that the Clean Water Council has ever recommended has recommended that the Mississippi River be tested for drinking water pollutants. Nobody tests the drinking water, the Mississippi, for drinking water pollutants. And everybody knows the Crow is very polluted. So my question to you is, why has the Clean Water Council never recommended funding for systematic testing of the Mississippi for drinking water contaminants?
That was my question.
Great. I believe Chair Wagenius, Representative Ertl wants to take credit for that question as well. So
that was my question.
Oh. I'm not sure. Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, thank you for the question. I checked in with a couple entities. One was the Mid Council, which does do testing in the Mississippi, but it's for a very limited number of things. And I think your concern is that there are other pollutants of concern that aren't tested, or there aren't health risk values, for example. And NDMA is one byproduct, I think, from a precursor that could be in the North Fork of the Crow and then interacts with a disinfectant chemical. That's outside my area of expertise, but I don't know if you were a catalyst for it or not, but the MPCA and the Department of Health have started to work together to identify pollutants of concern. I don't have a timeline when the first list would be, but that would inform what they want to go look for and monitor in the future. I'd probably have to go beyond that and ask Mr. Berman.
Representative Wagenius.
The basic question is, nobody right now, we don't have baseline data, and we don't have a plan for systematic testing. We've known about these pollutants for decades. So the question is, why hasn't the Clean Water Council recommended funding for testing for drinking water contaminants?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Gardner.
Certainly the last set of recommendations was before my time, but as I understand it, we have generally we have two pots. One is the monitoring and assessment money, where waters are tested on a 10-year cycle, and then there's a contaminants for emergent concern program through the Department of Health, which has a very limited number of things that are submitted for nomination to have a look at for doing health values. And those are usually proposed by people who are finding stuff on the water. I can't give you an answer for why the Clean Water Council didn't look that way. I don't know if they deferred to the agencies. That wasn't in, I'm not sure that was in the question that I thought you'd ask, so I didn't do some digging, but I'd be happy to carry that back to the council.
Chair Wagenius.
If you remember, and I'm sure you do, and I know Representative Murphy does, and Representative Hausman remembers, that when we took the question to the people whether we were going to do the constitutional amendment, the question to the people started with, in order to protect drinking water sources. So we've spent probably $100 million testing for other things, but not drinking water. So that's one of my questions. So the second thing that I've been thinking a lot about, this federal government has not enacted a new clean water standard since 1996, but the science is telling, that's 25 years ago, science is telling us a lot about, you mentioned NDMA, but PFAS and phthalates and bisphenol A, lots of hormone disruptors, pesticides. Some of them we've known about for 25 years. Some of them we've known about for 10 years. and we don't have standards. So why hasn't the Clean Water Council recommended money for establishing standards for things that are getting in drinking water?
Administrator Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vigenius, I just want to make sure I wrote it down. And again, that preceded my time. I'm certainly open to bringing that to them. We're about to embark on our next biennial funding process starting this month. So we'll be hearing proposals from now until June, putting a package together.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Vigenius.
Members, the reason I bring this up is if you will remember that we brought a package from Chair Hansen's committee of $7 million to you in the recommendations from Environment Finance to you included $7 million to do two things: to test surface water for drinking water contaminants and to make additional standards for things that we know are getting in drinking water. And folks in the Clean Water Council and one of your testifiers testified against getting that money. So health, in effect, said, no, we don't want the money. So my question to you is, what is going on?
Administrator Gardner or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vigenius, there has been a desire by the council to keep their recommendations intact. I wouldn't say that as a group of volunteers, it takes a long time before we even meet, about a month, so it's awfully hard for us to pivot. So the default position has usually been to stick with the recommendations, and the governor's office, who we work with very closely on the recommendations, felt very similar. Didn't mean that we don't think it's important.
So what you're telling us,
Chair Vigenius,
is your process is more important than my citizens' drinking water.
Administrator Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vigenius, I serve the council, and if they want to keep the recommendations together, that's what I'm going to recommend doing. We have been seeking out input for the last 9 months on different priorities to put in a strategic plan. Drinking water has certainly come up to the top, and we're including some items, particularly in private wells, that we have never considered before because we looked at drinking water sources and not the water at the tap. I understand that you brought this up to the council before, and I don't know what the flavor of the discussion was like, but when I started the job, we wanted to stick together on keeping the recommendations whole so that the legislature in both houses didn't pick it apart in lots of different ways, and the governor supported that position as well.
I think the governor probably
Chair
did
Vigenius.
Not understand that you were saying that your process was more important than the drinking water for Minneapolis and St. Paul and the suburbs. I don't think the governor knew that. So I don't think you should lean, unless you have a letter from the governor saying that, I don't think you should use the governor's name in that respect. So, members, do we have a few more minutes that I can tell the story?
We have the room till about 2:15. I don't know if there's other members that have questions, or Representative Green, Representative Erdahl have their bodies looking like there's questions.
I'm just going to speak into the mic so I can hear.
Speak into the mic.
Representative Vigenius, if you could get the mic a little closer, because
okay.
Thank
so,
you.
So just
before, could we just, let's just hop to Representative Green for a question and we'll go come back. Is that all right? Or was there a series of?
Oh, I have.
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you. And thanks, Representative Vigenius, because, you know, I hear you talk about clean drinking water all the time, and I know it's important. I get mine from a well, so it's I don't usually worry too much. I figure I've been drinking from the same water since I was a boy, and I'm still alive, so it probably isn't too bad. But my question is for the Minnesota Department of Health. Do you normally just go and do testing of the drinking water, or do you wait until there's a problem? So let's say, for instance, you haven't, if it's true you haven't tested the drinking water in Minneapolis, has there been any cases where people have gotten sick or any diseases have come up in that area?
Thank you. You heard the question, I'm sure. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members Thank you. Of the committee. My name is Sandeep Berman. I'm the manager of the Drinking Water Protection Program at the Department of Health. And speaking to Representative Green's question, all public water supplies in the state are monitored for an extensive list of contaminants that are regulated by the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. And speaking to Representative Vaginius's point, which is very valid, the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act has, in the eyes of many, including Department of Health, not kept up with the science in terms of the occurrence of other contaminants that are beyond the list. But the contaminants that are on the federal list are tested for at all public water supplies, including Minneapolis. The distinction is the water that's tested is the finished water, the water that's going to the public, not the water that's coming from the source, which Representative Vaginius very rightfully pointed out that there's definitely a gap in the sampling of source waters that is not covered under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. So the State Department of Health, we have expanded our efforts with the support of the Clean Water Council and the LCCMR to take measured steps into sampling source waters and then working with the public water supply systems to have them, at this point, voluntarily take steps, because again, they're not required under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act to respond to contaminants that are in the source water and that are not on the federally mandated list.
Thank you, Director. Representative Green?
Thank you. I don't want to take away from Representative Vaginius, but my concern as listening to this is, and I think you just answered it, that the people drinking the water are, for all practical purposes, safe. You just want to know why you have to treat for the stuff coming in. So there's no health danger right now?
Director Berman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. So as far as defined by the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, every public water supply in the state has to be in compliance. They are not permitted to supply water to any of their consumers that exceeds any of those federal standards. So that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Green, we don't know. Okay. The problem is, if you don't test the source water, you don't know what's to look for in the finished water. That's one thing. And we also know science is good on this, actually. Science is telling us there are things that can go through the system, particularly hormone disruptors, which won't affect you and won't affect me, but you don't want them for your grandchildren. So that's one thing. And you can say that we're following the federal standards, but remember, 1996, that's their latest standard. And for example, we test for some pesticides that we've known about in Minnesota, atrazine. We test for that, but we don't test for any of the breakdown products of atrazine. Sometimes breakdown products can be worse than the original parent. We don't test. We don't know whether they accumulate. We just don't know. So one of the things I wanted to bring up to members, and you know, since this was not a noticed hearing, there are not many people here to talk about it, and so this will probably disappear into the wind. But on your own website, you had this notice that neonicotinoids are in surface water, and they're a pesticide of concern. So the Department of Ag is going to talk about best management practices. You don't talk about testing for them in drinking water. So they are in surface water, pesticides of concern, found in limits above what you would expect and are not good, and yet you're not even talking about testing for them, or your standard, which you don't have a standard for them either. So I'm not understanding
And Representative Green, you told, when you got the answer about municipal wells, and if you drink from a municipal well, it has been tested for things we knew about a long time ago and a few other things. But folks who drink water from a private well, we don't help at all. And people who drink water from surface water, we don't help at all. So there is a group that's helped, but there's a group that's not. And so I am talking about the group that's not. So if I could...
Thank you, Chair Wiginius. We might have to have another opportunity. This just a minor correction. This is a public announced... Oh, theirs. Okay, I thought you meant our meeting. Okay, ours was, this was a noticed meeting. Okay, thank you.
The meeting was noticed, but people didn't know that we were going to be discussing this, is what I said.
Okay.
So I would like at some point to tell the story of how I knew accidentally about how my drinking water, or the citizens in my district, was not being protected. And I don't know whether you want to get into that now or if you'd like to do it another time.
Chair Wiginius, I'm inclined to say we need to do it, have another visit. I feel bad, you know, to cut you short, and I think we can all learn from the discussion. So I think we'll reach out to the folks that came today and have them have another visit if they're up to it, and well. They will be, and so I think at this time I think it's probably a good point to adjourn and to move forward and revisit and have another conversation another time. We're kind of at our time limit, and I think we've had some good discussion on the bills today, and thank you for coming, Mr. Gardner and directors. Thank you, and I think with that I think we're going to close for today. With that, we're adjourned.